Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for January 21st, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the neural basis of expert intuition, a cancer that captures its host, mitochondria, and assuring the continued supply of radiopharmaceuticals. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about microscopic farmers, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Amateur or professional, novice or expert, which are you? According to a report from the U.S. National Resource Council, one of the differences between novices and experts is that experts notice features and meaningful patterns of information that are not noticed by novices. Quantifying that ability to recognize features and patterns, however, is difficult. But now, in a paper in this week's Science, Keiji Tanaka and colleagues have shown that experts use different parts of their brains than novices do when engaged in their expert subject. Science's Sophia Kai has more.
Just from everyday experience, most of us intuitively know whether a puddle is too big for us to hop over or how hard to brake when riding a bike downhill. But people who practice something so much that they become experts at it develop a kind of intuition that goes way beyond everyday experience, such as finding solutions to very specific problems very quickly, without stopping to think. An example of such expert intuition is found among professional players of a game called shogi.
Shogi is Japanese chess, similar to chess, but a little more complicated.
Keiji Tanaka is a neuroscientist at Riken in Wako, Japan, who wanted to understand what part of the brain is used in expert intuition. The hope is that understanding the neural circuitry involved in playing shogi may help in understanding how we process other information, make decisions, and achieve goals, such as troubleshooting a complicated engineering system and finding the one part of thousands that is going wrong.
And this intuition seems to be field-specific and the result of long-term training. Psychologists say at least 10 years, everyday extensive training. But there is almost no knowledge about where in the brain it is performed.
So Tanaka and his team used functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI scans, to look inside the brains of shogi players while they were playing.
Shogi is very popular in Japan, and there are 160 active professional players. So by using these professional players, and also we imaged the amateur players, we found that the professional players are clearly different. They make different use of the brain in their problem solving.
And just as you might expect, or intuit, Tanaka and his team found that the intuition of experts was different from the intuition of amateurs in the brain.
We found that precuneus, a part of the parietal cortex, was specifically activated by actual shogi patterns, but not by other objects. So we first found that precuneus is important for perception, quick understanding of the shogi board patterns.
What Tanaka means by shogi board patterns is situations in the game that come up during play. And when Tanaka says the precuneus is used for quick understanding, Tanaka means really quick, just seconds.
8 seconds is short for me, but long enough for professional players. They make logical thinking, and not only the next move, but they search the next move, including opponent move, several steps. And then searched many possibilities and find the best selection.
Now, both professional and amateur players were able to come up with good solutions, and several cortical areas of the brain were similarly activated in both types of players. But in a follow-up experiment, when the players were required to respond even faster, just a second to see the board and 2 more seconds to choose the best next move from among 4 choices, the amateurs usually failed to choose the optimal move.
But the professional players can report the correct answer in 70% of the trials. Then we found that in professional players, during this quick generation, the basal ganglia was activated. So taken together, these 2 sets of results, we conclude that basal ganglia is specific to the quick generation.
Psychologist and chess expert Fernand Gobet says it's this activation of the basal ganglia, or more specifically, a region in the basal ganglia called the caudate nucleus, that is key. Gobet works at Brunel University and is not associated with the paper.
The pretty good news was found in one of the experiments I carried out in chess. That's not totally new. So the real contribution of the paper is to show that one specific part of the brain, the precuneus, will first encode perceptual information, and this is linked to another part of the brain, the head of caudate nucleus, which encodes information about actions.
And those actions are, for shogi experts, directed towards the goal of winning the game, even if the best next move means sacrificing a player, or, as is allowed in shogi, using the move to take a player that's already been eliminated and put it back on the board. Again, Fernand Gobet.
The idea is that you first recognize a perceptual pattern in the first part of the brain they have identified, which is the precuneus. So this is purely perceptual. Then activity moves to the caudate nucleus, where you identify a move. And basically, you have this stimulus response, which provides you an automatic access to a solution.
But figuring out how the brains of experts come to do this, and in such a short amount of time, is still an open question. Study author Keiji Tanaka and his team ruled out habits because there are too many patterns that come up in shogi. They also ruled out a lookup table approach that goes through every board pattern ever seen, as even shogi-playing supercomputers that use that strategy fail to beat professional shogi players. Instead, Fernand Gobet thinks that shogi game experts use something called chunks to help categorize board patterns and strategic moves.
Basically, chunks are perceptual patterns that can be used as a unit. So if you're a beginner and you look at a shogi board or a chess board, you recognize only one piece at a time, and you can memorize only one piece at a time. If you become a better player, then you can learn to recognize groups of pieces, maybe a bishop together with a knight or a bishop with a king and two pawns and so on and so forth. When you learn to read, at least in some languages, you first learn the letters, and then you learn to put the letters together in syllables, and then you learn about words. So that's exactly the same idea. So you start with a very simple unit, and you learn to put these units together. And the idea for shogi is that what experts do is to learn these perceptual units. And not only do they learn these perceptual units, but these units get attached to information that could be useful.
This idea of becoming an expert by learning these chunks is not new. The idea has been circulating for decades, ever since psychologists determined in the 1950s that professional and amateur chess players didn't differ in the depth or breadth of their search for the best next move. But while the world-class players would usually find the optimal move in their search, the amateurs typically would not. Again, study author Keiji Tanaka.
So this indicates that the idea of the best next move is not conclusion of the search, but the idea came before the search. And psychologists thought that chunks are stored in the long-term memory and chunks should be associated with the idea of the best next move. But the question is where this knowledge is associated and the mechanism of the association.
A question that, so far, researchers haven't been able to answer. For Science Magazine, I'm Sophia Kai.
You can read Tanaka and colleagues' paper titled The Neural Basis of Intuitive Best Next Move Generation in Board Game Experts. Find it in this week's Science. Canine transmissible venereal tumor is a cancer of dogs, wolves, and coyotes that previous research has shown originated about 10,000 years ago, which is just a few thousand years after scientists think dogs were domesticated. There's some speculation that because the first domesticated dogs were likely very inbred, the dogs' genetic similarity to one another allowed cancer from one dog to grow on another, like a parasite. As the dog breeds diverged, the cancer, which multiplies asexually, evolved to be able to grow on diverse hosts. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Claire Rebeck and colleagues report that at least one of the ways this cancer continues to live is by capturing the energy-producing mitochondria from the hosts, the dogs' cells. Rebeck says the research suggests new avenues to explore in treating a variety of mitochondrial-related diseases. I spoke with her from her office at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory.
We had previously studied nuclear markers, and these confirmed that the canine cancers were distributed throughout the world and came from a common ancestor. In this study, we actually took a closer look at the mitochondrial markers, variations found within the DNA of the cells of the mitochondria. These were able to provide us with an additional source of information on the relatedness of these cancers to each other and to the dog breeds that exist today. We found that the mitochondrial genomes of the cancers were in some cases more related to non-related dogs than they were to each other, which suggests that there was not a common origin within the mitochondrial genome, which led us to suggest that the mitochondrial DNA was somehow being transferred from the host dog at some point in time into the tumor.
When you found that the genomes of the mitochondria didn't follow the pattern of relatedness that the nuclear genomes did of the cancer cells, what did you think?
We thought it was very unusual. We originally looked at the D-loop region of the mitochondria, which is not under any selective pressure, and we thought perhaps this region was just under high mutation rate. So by looking at the coding regions and finding the same result, we did think this was very unusual.
So it's not a function of the mitochondrial genome just mutating?
We didn't think so. The mitochondrial genome does tend to mutate quite quickly, but we also looked at coding regions which are supposed to mutate less rapidly, and we found that there were still more mutations in the coding regions than we had expected. Given that the cancer cases that we had appeared to have a common ancestor, the expectation was that all the cancer genomes would cluster as one group and all the host and the non-related dog genomes would cluster as another group. Given this wasn't the case, we began to suspect that there was an alternative hypothesis, which led us to suggest that the mitochondrial genome was being passed on from a different source.
And that's what led you to investigate the relatedness with the dog's mitochondria. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. How does this cancer spread?
The cancer is spread by transmission of the cell itself. So rather than somatic or hereditary mutations, it's the actual cell which is grafted onto a new host and grows from there.
Is there something about that way of spreading, that transmission, that correlates with this apparent ability to grab mitochondria from the host, the dog?
We don't think so. We think it's more an age-related phenomenon. The age of the tumor itself has allowed this adaptation to develop.
And what, if any, evolutionary advantage does this cancer get from grabbing mitochondria from its host?
Due to the ancient age of the cancer, then we suspect that there is degeneration of the mitochondrial genome. The mitochondria actually sources many functions, and if it degrades, then the functions become less efficient. So in order to increase its efficiency, it likely takes up the mitochondria of the host.
How old is this cancer?
We calculated from a previous study that the tumor itself is approximately around 10,000 years old. However, the samples that we collected came from a single origin approximately around 500 to 600 years ago.
And why does that age suggest that the mitochondria would degrade in function during that time?
Because it's passed on from one dog to another. The cell itself does not die per se. So there is no selection for an improved cell. So the mutations just tend to arise and accumulate as time progresses, which causes lack of function in the mitochondrial genome.
In the literature, has anyone reported this mechanism before, this grabbing of mitochondria from host cells?
There is some reports of in vitro studies which have shown that mitochondria are able to rescue other cells which don't have any mitochondria in them. But this has only been shown in mammalian cell culture.
So is there something then that's particular and unique about this canine transmissible venereal cancer and this ability, or does it suggest that other cancers might do this too?
We think that it's possibly unique in this cancer, but we don't know if it actually happens in other cancers. It may well do, but the frequency with which it occurs probably will not show up in many of the cancers that we see today, as in it doesn't occur very frequently.
Does this understanding suggest any new avenues for treatment or prevention from this type of cancer?
For this particular cancer, probably not. However, due to there's many hereditary diseases are caused by mutations in the mitochondrial genome and also environmentally induced mutations. So the potential that mitochondria can be transferred from one cell to another could demonstrate a use for how to aid these diseases. So how to treat them, possibly.
So what's next for you, then, along this research path?
Along this research, I'm actually collaborating with another researcher who's looking at sequencing the genome of the mitochondria of the tumor and also the nuclear genome to see if there's anything further that can be established.
So a full sequence, then?
Yes.
Okay. Claire Rebeck, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Claire Rebeck of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory is lead author of a paper in this week's Science on mitochondrial capture by a transmissible cancer.
This is a story about efforts to produce radiopharmaceuticals, new ways to produce radiopharmaceuticals used in nuclear medicine procedures around the world.
Science's Robert Service reports in this week's issue on assuring the continued supply of medically useful radioactive materials, particularly given rising security and proliferation concerns.
There are quite a number of radioisotopes used for imaging and therapy for a wide variety of things. In particular, there is a radioisotope called technetium-99 that is extremely valuable. It's used in over 30 million procedures worldwide every year. It's used in everything from cancer detection, detection of heart disease, thyroid disease, brain and kidney function. It's really valuable as a radiopharmaceutical because it emits gamma radiation. So that's what helps in the imaging technique. The detectors can pick that up. But it has a very short half-life, only 6 hours, which means the technetium-99 that is injected into a person's body, the radioactivity from that dies away very quickly. So it can be used for an imaging procedure, and then it just goes away. And so that makes it very valuable because you don't want to expose patients to more radiation than necessary.
And why a call for new technologies to make these nuclear materials? What's the concern over how these nuclear materials are made now?
So these concerns that I'll lay out are unique to technetium-99. Not all radioisotopes are made in this fashion, but technetium-99 being so important, it's used in about 80% of all nuclear medicine procedures. So there's two main challenges with producing technetium-99. The way it's been produced historically is in nuclear reactors. So you start with uranium-235, and this is the uranium used in nuclear weapons. You put that in a nuclear reactor, it gets exposed to neutrons. That causes it to fission or to break apart, and one of the daughters of that split is a form of molybdenum called molybdenum-99, and that then can lose a gamma ray, and when it does, that becomes technetium-99.
So there are security concerns?
So there are proliferation concerns. And the challenge is that the moly-99 has a half-life of only 66 hours, and technetium-99 has a half-life of only 6 hours. So these things can't be stockpiled. So that means that these reactors must get continual shipments of U-235 targets. The processing to purify the moly-99 creates high-level waste, and that has security concerns on its own. Now, the good news about producing in a reactor is it can be very efficient. You can make lots of it. The challenge is that there's only a handful of reactors that do this around the world. Right now, about 5 reactors produced 95 to 99% of all the molybdenum-99 and therefore the technetium-99 that is used in medical procedures. And unfortunately, these are old, aging reactors that are, in many cases, well beyond their design life. So they have lots of issues with trying to keep these reactors up and running. Over the last few years, for example, a couple of reactors, one in Canada, another in the Netherlands, have had to be shut down, either repeatedly shut down or shut down and stay shut down for repairs. And that's put a lot of pressure on the other producers to make enough molybdenum-99 for all the patients that need it.
Is the frequent shutdown of these old nuclear reactors what's driving the call for new technology?
I think the shutdown is driving it as well as the security concerns. The security concerns are really moving front and center right now, because there was an agreement last April among 47 countries to phase out civilian uses of highly enriched uranium. And that, of course, would cover this use. And so, well, they're not going to do it overnight. These governments have committed to phasing out this process. So that means people have to come up with alternative ways of making moly-99 and tech-99.
And what, if any, techniques have they come up with, new technologies that might replace the current method of using this weapons-grade uranium to make medically useful isotopes?
Well, in many cases, they're not necessarily new technologies. It's just that they've been on the back burner for so long because the way that folks have been making it up till now has been rather efficient, and it's done the job. So one way is a different reactor design. It's actually a very old technology. It's called aqueous homogeneous reactors. And these can be small reactors the size of about a 55-gallon drum, which is about a couple hundred liters. And most nuclear reactors in their core have these solid uranium rods that drive the nuclear reaction. In this one, it's a uranium salt in acidic solution. So it's a solution-based reactor. And then they use low-enriched uranium as the quote-unquote target dissolved in the solution. And then they can just do the separation chemistry through wet chemistry. It makes the separation of the molybdenum that gets produced in that reactor relatively simple. You don't have to dissolve a target in acid, so you're generating less waste. Another option is, well, then there's a couple of options that get away from fission altogether. And the challenge here, again, is just efficiency. Can you produce enough of it to basically help all the patients?
You said there were government concerns. I assume that all of these reactors are in some way government supported. Is that right?
The reactors that produce Moly-99 through fission of U-235 today, yes, are government sponsored.
So going forward, will governments be paying for and securing these other materials, assuming weapons-grade uranium is not needed ongoing for the creation of these medically useful isotopes?
Right. That's going to be a challenge, because if governments continue to support some of the reactors and produce, let's just pick a number, let's say they produce 50% of the molybdenum-99 in that fashion, and that is not a commercial enterprise. That's a government-sponsored facility, and maybe it has lots of other uses, but one of the uses is producing radiopharmaceuticals. So part of the challenge is going to be for governments to price their molybdenum-99 in ways that doesn't discourage companies from getting in the business. There has been so little commercial development of this field, even though it's become a fairly sizable business, because companies are worried that at any given time their price can just be undercut by governments supporting a research facility for other means, for other uses. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. There are a number of organizations out there that have been calling on governments to make sort of a collective statement on this about what's the best way to proceed. That way they can give the market some clear direction on what to expect, and that might help spur investment in this area.
Bob Service, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science's Bob Service reports in this week's issue on assuring the continued supply of medically useful radioactive materials, particularly given rising security and proliferation concerns. Finally today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about microscopic farmers. What are these farmers, Dave, and what are they farming?
Well, these farmers are a type of amoeba known as Dictyostelium discoideum, or Dicty for short, and these are single-celled organisms that already have quite a reputation in the scientific community. These are actually really interesting organisms. They were formerly classified as slime molds, and they have this really interesting lifestyle. For most of their lives, they exist as these single-cell amoeba. They can live in the dirt, and they suck bacteria up from the dirt, and they eat the bacteria. But when the food runs out, a bunch of them get together, and they form this slug-like organism that can migrate to new places and form this stalk with what's called a fruiting body at the top, which is sort of like this bulb at the top, which is filled with amoeba. And this stalk sheds the amoeba off, and these amoeba land in new places, hopefully places with more food. It's a really interesting lifestyle. You can actually see a very cool video of this happening on the site. So these organisms were already famous, and now they're famous for something else besides having this really interesting lifestyle, and that is their ability to farm. And what do we mean by farming here? Well, these amoeba actually seem to be farming bacteria.
So they're growing the food, just as we do. Livestock farming.
Something like that, exactly.
So do they transport the bacteria from place to place during this stalk and fruiting body phase?
Exactly. In this fruiting body, there's actually a bunch of bacteria hanging out in this fruiting body, which is how researchers first discovered this farming behavior. A graduate student was looking at these fruiting bodies and said, hey, there's bacteria in there. There shouldn't be bacteria in there. And she kept on studying these Dicti organisms. And what she found was that not only were there bacteria in this fruiting body, but as the amoeba sort of sloughed off the fruiting body, they were carrying bacteria with them, and that when she took these amoeba and put them in new environments that didn't have any food or any bacteria, as it were, these amoeba would start growing these bacteria and feeding off them. And what's cool about this is we know other organisms that do this. We've had stories in the past about ants who actually farm fungi. They have fungal gardens that they actually tend to. And that's a bit more of a complicated farming behavior than what we're seeing here. And we're anthropomorphizing a little bit anyways by calling this farming. But it's just fascinating to see that even an extremely tiny organism, much, much smaller than an ant and other organisms that we associate with farming, can still do the basic task that we associate with farming a crop, and in this case, the crop is bacteria.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the world's tiniest farmers to the universe's largest black hole, this next story is about the most massive black hole that's ever been measured. This black hole is located in a galaxy called M87, which is by far the largest and most massive galaxy in the universe. So a good place to find a very massive black hole, a very massive galaxy. And this galaxy is about 50 million light years away in the direction of the constellation Virgo, if that means anything to you.
It does.
And actually, researchers have actually known about this black hole for a while, but these things are very hard to measure, as you can imagine. First of all, we can't really see a black hole. We can't even see the event horizon, which is the outer edge of the black hole from which nothing can escape, not even light. So it's very hard to measure these objects. And this new measurement took the strength of the Frederick C. Gillett Gemini Telescope in Mauna Kea, Hawaii. And astronomers studied this black hole for a while. They were able to factor out some things that confound measurements, such as the blurring effects of Earth's atmosphere. And they were able to calculate the black hole's mass after doing all this. And what they found was the black hole weighs about 6.6 billion times the mass of the sun. That's huge, even for a black hole. There's a black hole postulated to be in the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and that only weighs about 3 million times the mass of our sun. So we're talking about something over 2,000 times more massive than the black hole at the center of the Milky Way.
So is this discovery adding to our understanding of black holes in general, how our universe works, or why are researchers interested in looking up and measuring the size of black holes?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And, you know, scientists don't just do this for a new entry in the record books, although this is a very impressive entry. What they're really trying to find out is more about black holes. As I mentioned earlier, it's very hard to observe these objects, and especially the event horizon. So when you have something this large that can be studied in this amount of detail, it could give astronomers and physicists clues to how black holes form and more information about what they look like.
Do they have any understanding of how this one formed and got so big?
Well, what they think happened is it probably emerged from the merger of at least a couple of other very large black holes. In fact, they think the galaxy it came from, M87, also came about by the merger of other smaller galaxies. So it's possible when these other galaxies merged, their black holes may have merged as well. And what you end up with is this supermassive black hole at the center of this galaxy. It still needs to be studied, but it's an intriguing hypothesis for now.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from black holes that suck things in to bird nests that keep things out, this last story is about a bird that decorates its nest in such a way that intruders are scared off.
Something about the construction or what the nest is actually made out of?
It's actually what the nest is made out of. Now, we already know that birds construct nests out of elaborate materials. Some of them take berries and sticks and shells and a bunch of other things to make their nests. And usually scientists think they do this, especially the male birds do this, to attract a female. Males that create very elaborate or very attractive nests are more likely to woo a mate and therefore produce offspring. But there are some species, including the species focused on in this study, which is called the black kite, which is a medium-sized bird of prey that lives in Europe, Asia, Australia, and Africa, where the males don't seem to be building a nest to attract the females. And that's because the males and the females pair up before the nest is built, and they actually help build the nest together. So the male has no incentive to make a pretty nest for the female because he's already got her. And yet they make very elaborate nests. They tend to take garbage, human garbage, from the ground. They're especially fond of white pieces of plastic, and you can see a picture of a nest constructed this way on the site. So researchers said, well, why are these birds constructing these really elaborate nests with these shiny white pieces of plastic if they're not doing it for mating reasons?
So if not come hither, then go thither.
Exactly. And that's exactly what the researchers found. They found that the birds with the most decorated nest scared off intruders. And these are especially intruders that were interested in stealing food or even taking the nest for themselves. For some reason, they saw these nests and they flew away. And one reason that might be happening is that the birds that tended to decorate their nests the most tended to be most fit. In other words, they tended to have the most access to the food. They had the best hunting grounds. And so these birds may have been stronger to begin with. And by building these complicated nests, they may indicate to an intruder, hey, I'm a really strong bird, or I have a lot of vigor. And then this intruder is more likely to stay away.
So the quality of the nest is associated essentially with the quality or fitness of the bird.
Exactly.
Could there be another explanation?
Well, you know, this is really the first time that it's been seen where biologists have seen what they believe is a bird decorating its nest for this purpose. But because this is the first time this has been seen, it hasn't been extensively studied. So scientists are really going to have to take a closer look at this to find out what's really going on here. But this seems to be the best explanation so far.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about pterosaur eggs. These are winged animals that lived at the time of the dinosaurs, and what it tells us about the evolution of these really fascinating creatures. And we've also got a story about the hottest planet ever found. It's a real scorcher, so you'll want to be sure to check that out. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about budget cuts, but not in the US this time, actually in the UK, and what the implications are of those cuts for UK science. And then in the US, we've got a story about the National Institutes of Health creating a new center and also breaking up an old one and what the implications of that are for biomedical research over the next decade. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the January 21st, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.